call the House Health Care Committee together, and I'll open up a public hearing on HB 2116.
And I'll close the public hearing on HB 2116. And we'll stand at ease for
a moment till we get more committee. Public hearing on 3175.
And ask Representative Gilliam to join us.
3175.
Is there anybody else on this hearing? Oh, 3175.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. It's Vic Gilliam from District 18.
Is that mic on?
Certainly hope not.
He's very soft-spoken, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Could you project?
Yes.
Good afternoon, Prozo, Mr. Chair.
Not singing. No.
Do your best, Jeff Krupp.
Mr. Chair and committee members, it's Vic Gilliam from District 18. It's my pleasure to come to you and just say a word about a repeat bill, 3175. The chair is far more articulate about this, but I just wanted to kick it off in this regard. I am bringing it at the request of a constituent of mine who this committee, the makeup of this committee of the 07 and 08 sessions, heard from, who is not able to be with us today. Her name is Brenda Ross. And Brenda had a situation that caused her a great deal of pain and injury, and had tried very hard to find out information about her physician and felt that she was unable to do so and probably would not have gone under this person's care had she known the number of complaints that were against this physician. Today, she stands legally blind in one eye and, as a matter of fact, is on a trip right now to Canada where she's searching for a manufacturer and a physician who has a very large contact lens that could possibly help her with her vision in that eye. And she's not very happy that we scheduled this, but I told her today, but I told her that's just the way it goes in the legislature, and she asked me to pinch it. I think that We had a good hearing the last time, and as the chair knows, we admonished folks from the medical examiner office to take a look at this. And unfortunately, what happened, from my point of view, is that in the 08 session, if I'm not mistaken, in the 07 session, Senate Bill 337 actually had a provision that reversed what I think the direction we should be going. So the new bill that you have in front of us, in front of you, 3175, has a couple of interesting highlights that I'll just quickly mention. On page 3, line 19, we are attempting in the bill to have for your consideration to remove the provision that I just referenced. You'll see there on 919, starting with the board shall, and you move on down. If you don't have any complaints, you get it. They will bring it off your record after 4 years. We're attempting to remove that section.
I'm sorry, Representative. Which? You're on page 2, and you're talking about which?
I'm sorry. I'm on page 3.
Page 3.
Line 19 in the parenthetical.
I have it. Thank you.
You got it. That's one. And then the other is on page 2. You'll want to review the whole bill, obviously, but these are the two points that I thought were particularly worth highlighting for you today. On line 20 of page 2, we've changed this to say that a person investigating a complaint shall report to the board as required not later than 90 days after the board receives the complaint. Part of the problem that we felt and that Brenda felt that we were experiencing was, for lack of a better way to put it, the dragging of feet on information. And that there would be, as you can see down on line 22, provision for one extension of 30 days. I think this bill, again, reminds us that we need more transparency and improves the ability for potential patients to get information about physicians. There's a number of issues that will be raised, I'm sure, but I wanted to bring the bill back, at least for the conversation, and I appreciate the chair's attention.
Thank you very much. Discussion? Representative Cannon?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gilliam or someone else on the committee, I'm trying to recall who, in line 20 of page 2, who we envisioned to be investigating the complaint that is obligated under this bill to report. Who typically is the investigator we have in mind when that provision was drafted?
Chair Greenlich may have a better answer than me. Representative Cannon, Chair Greenlich, I believe one of the references is to the medical examiner office.
No, not the medical examiner. That's the investigator of the Board of Medicine.
Or the investigator of the
case comes in and they do an investigation. They assign an investigator to it. And Ms. Haley is here. We can talk. We can check that out. But I'm sure that's to whom this reports. It's the investigator of the medical board reporting the findings of their investigation to the board for action.
Sorry for that mistake.
We have both an OMA and a board representative signed up, and we can talk about that.
So just to clarify, that a board's investigator is not under current law required to report to the board?
Within any time frame. I think that's the case, so okay. We'll ask Ms. Haley. But I think it's the issue of the time frame.
I would just, the only other thing I would add, Mr. Chair, is just simply, in this particular case...
How come I know your bill better than you do?
It's easy to do. In this particular case, my attention and passion for it has been because of what my constituent went through, and it isn't that her case should rise to the level of legislation. It isn't that each case isn't different, but I have to say, in her case, we let her down in terms of information that was available. In her case, there were many, many complaints. There were many, many settlements out of court. And in my view, to her credit, after she had a settlement and her part was done, she just thought about it and said, you know what, I'm not done. I think that we ought to have more transparency. If someone calls in the same situation, they ought to have more information than I was given to make an evaluation and determination.
For those
and
of you
that's
that,
why I'm here
that
today.
Weren't here to hear that last time, basically the testimony we heard, and I'm sorry she's not here, and you can tell us she should put it in writing, was that she needed to have eye surgery. She contacted the board to ask whether there were any complaints against the physician, the surgeon she was going to use. What she thinks she heard, and we're not getting into any issue about what she heard, but what she thinks she heard was there were no complaints against that doctor. What in fact she found out later was there were complaints against that doctor. There were cases in progress, and I guess Ms. Haley can talk about it. There were cases in progress, but they hadn't had action yet, so they weren't reported to the public because the board had not acted on those cases. And furthermore, there had been several malpractice cases that had been settled out of court with a confidentiality provision in those settlements. So at that time, the board didn't have to report those either. We've changed that in the 2007. And what later became public, if she had called several months later, she would have gotten some of this information, although not all of it, that would have got her to not use that position. So the purpose of this is to move that process along, not to change the process, basically, but to move it along so that there would be more timely information. And there would be information under this about complaints that were resolved to be not substantiated. It would still be, the information would be there was a complaint. The board investigated and found that it was not substantiated, what the nature of that complaint was. And basically, that's what we're talking about here. Okay? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Go back and save us from puppy mills, please.
I will. And thank you for hearing this bill. And for reasons I've already demonstrated, you have a better handle on it than I do.
Can we have Mike Crew? That's Cooney Crew is the firm, I assume. Is that
correct,
right? There's not somebody else named Cooney Crew coming to testify.
No.
And Kathleen Haley. I thought maybe you were bringing somebody with you to.
I probably should have.
you'll have Miss Haley to protect you.
Then I'm in good hands.
And she'll promise not to report anything about it either. So.
For the record, my name is Mike Crew. I'm an attorney with the law firm of Cooney and Crew, and I'm the only one from Cooney and Crew that's going to be here. you know, it's unfortunate that we couldn't hear the testimony of Ms. Ross, because it may be that there's some misunderstanding going back and forth about what the board does or doesn't report or is required to report. But that said, I'm an attorney. I represent physicians generally who are called before the board at times. I've also represented a fair number of dentists who are called before their board, as well as other professionals when they're called before their boards. Now, there's been a law or a series of laws in place since 1997 that are in place there to protect the public. And I want to back up and throw a few numbers at you because I think it's important. According to the information that's publicly available from the dental board, less than 1 in 7 complaints that are filed with that board result in any discipline of their licensees. And I think Ms. Haley will also confirm that complaints coming before the medical board, it's roughly about 1 in 5 result in any kind of discipline. Now, you have to ask yourself a question about relevancy, because the fact of the matter is any member of the public with immunity granted under Oregon statute, can file a good faith complaint against a doctor or a dentist and not be liable for any kind of slander or anything else. Now, the law is such that it protects the process of the investigation. And these investigations, by the way, regardless of what some people may think, are not very friendly toward the licensees. They're very thorough, and they result, in some cases, in some pretty stiff sanctions. But the point is that if an investigation does not result in any finding of a violation of the standard, one has to ask himself, what value is it in publishing that information to the public, particularly the contents of the complaint which this bill calls for? It, in my view, is providing misinformation and can be misleading if it's not misunderstood or if it's not understood by the party that's receiving it. And one of the goals, I believe, of this session has been, granted, to make the licensing process, the HPP process, and other processes before these boards transparent. But another goal of the board, or of this session, seems to be one of consistency across all boards. In this case, you're singling out the medical board for disparate treatment. If you look at 676.175 and 180 and other related statutes in that section of the code, you will find that all these boards are treated equally relative to this process. And there is a way for the public to get at information. They have to demonstrate a need for it. And the doctor or the dentist or other licensee has a right to challenge the release of that information if they don't believe it should be released. That due process is there to protect the licensees from release of information that arguably would be slanderous to them if it's released into the public domain. We had this argument in 1997, and those laws were put in place, and I believe, with minor exception, no one has ever challenged the process. The process is there, it has been used, and it's been used effectively for those that want to use it. But just to tell someone who contacts the OMB, well, Dr. Crew has had 15 complaints against him. Oh, by the way, none of them were well-founded. You have to ask yourself, what good is that information? It's our view that the law as written in Chapter 676 protects the public and is not necessary to use this case as a springboard to basically, as far as I can see, single out physicians and the medical board for disparate treatment.
Questions of Mr. Crew? I have a question. It's been reported that the bar treats this differently. And in your experience, you must have represented attorneys, I imagine, too. And
I have.
Some things. How does the bar deal with public information about complaints?
The bar is an open book. If you complain about a lawyer, it's put in their file, and any member of the public can see a lawyer's file. It's that simple. That doesn't mean that
you have to go down and do it. I think it's not on the website.
Correct. You can go down there and you can look through and see all the complaints filed against any lawyer that you care to look at and parse through the information.
Is it your impression that has a dilatory effect on lawyers? I mean,
well,
that's an example that's been given to compare with this.
You know, we hear this all the time. And all I can say to this is, obviously, I am a lawyer. I don't agree with that process. But so be it. That's the process we're stuck with, and the bar supports it. So that's the way it's going to be. But that has not been the process historically with the OMB.
It has not. Any questions of Mr. Crew?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
I think he alluded to Section 676, and in particular the stipulation that a member of the public can request information related to complaints under this provision in law. They are required to demonstrate a clear and convincing evidence that public interest in disclosure outweighs other interests in non-disclosure. Has this provision been, I kind of want to have a sense of its force and its efficacy. This relates to a 1997 law, and whether, and try to get a sense of whether this is doing what we intended, and whether it would have addressed the situation that Representative Gilliam's constituent brought forward. Did she have a clear and convincing? I mean, that's just one of a number of questions I can imagine asking. But any background that you or Ms. Haley have on that provision, which would appear to at least try to balance the public's interest in disclosure with the physician's interest in, you know, privacy until verdict.
Well, I think Ms. Haley would be in a much better position to respond to that than I. I know of at least one, if not two, cases where it has been released in a demonstration of, well, there was a request, and I don't believe that the physician objected to it, and it was released. But I don't know of any case where a person has requested it and it has been denied. But I just don't have enough experience with that.
Yeah, I mean, that is the question. The public interest is I want to find out whether to use that doctor or not. Is that a public interest that outweighs the private interest? Well, why don't you have with at us? Welcome
okay.
back.
Welcome.
Seeing you.
To you,
happy
too.
Happy to see you here.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. My name is Kathleen Haley. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Medical Board, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify on House Bill 3175, which would require the board to release information concerning complaints against its licensees prior to any discipline being taken. And like all of the other health regulatory boards in Oregon, the medical board currently treats complaints as confidential until the investigation is completed and the board has voted to issue a statement of the charges. It's at that point that it does become public. And this practice is, as Mr. Crewe mentioned, in accordance with ORS 676175 and an example of the consistency among all the health regulatory boards. It was enacted in 1997 and balances the public's right to know with the importance of providing verified information. The board's website currently contains the full text of public board orders, information on the closed malpractice cases, and licensing information. For those folks who do not have internet access, the board provides a toll-free number, and we have a complaint resource officer on staff who can provide assistance in obtaining information about licensees. Following the hearing on a bill similar to this in 2007, the board staff did adjust its response to public inquiries about complaints. When a request for information is made about a complaint, staff says that state law allows us to provide information about complaints that have resulted in disciplinary action. We also provide information about disciplinary actions that have taken place, or explain that there haven't been any complaints that have resulted in disciplinary actions. The board urges that you vote no on House Bill 3175 because it believes that it is working currently. We have had some requests for information under the clear and convincing provision of ORS 676, and we have provided that information. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Ask the question again?
Sure. I mean, you alluded to it, but a sense of how many times someone has asked for information on what grounds the board would use to determine whether or not a clear and convincing public interest exists.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Cannon, we have used it probably a half a dozen times or less, and we have turned it over to our Assistant Attorney General and asked him whether it met that guideline, and in each case he has said yes, and we've released it.
Do you have any, this may require more time on your part, but any idea of the rationale that how AG has interpreted this? And
Chair Greenlick, Representative Cannon, probably the most notorious case was that of Dr. Patel, and it was a request by the media for that information. I would need to go back and check with the AG on the other cases, and I could provide that to you in the future, you know, next week or this week.
Okay, that would be helpful.
Would you expect, though, that if I called up and said I'm about to have my eyes operated on, which is a pretty serious private interest, if not a public interest, and I wanted to know about any complaints about this physician, would you imagine turning that over to the Attorney General, or would you just sort of refuse that out of hand?
Oh, Chair Greenlick, no. In each case, we've turned it over to the Assistant Attorney General to take a look at.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
One of the other items in here is timeline.
Yes.
What's your normal timeline on dealing with complaints?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Kennemer, I think that the median to close a case is 160 days. Under ORS 676.165, there is a timeline in place right now of 120 days with 30-day adjustments upwards if needed. The thing that does slow down the investigators is really primarily getting patient records, and that's what takes the time to complete an investigation.
Do you have a sense of how the 90 days would work?
Chair Greenlick, I think it would be tough to meet simply because of this, of the record issue. Some of them are quite voluminous. In many instances, the board would like to have the case reviewed by a consultant. We try to fast-track that sometimes before we send the case to the board. So it would be tough to get a case, get the records, get the case sent to the consultant, get the report back from the consultant in that much time.
Do you have a comment on the deletion on page 3 of the bill, lines 19 to 21 to 22?
Chair Greenlick, before you move to that section, I'd like to throw an observation out of an unintended consequence of that timeline. We once had
specialize in unintended consequences.
There you go.
That's our.
We once had a similar provision by administrative rule as it relates to the dental board. And we lawyers representing our clients, if you didn't toe the line on those timelines, we would move for dismissal of the case because you went beyond the timeline. And I would suggest to you that if you enact this the way it's written, you may very well be giving us another arrow to shoot at Ms. Haley and the board.
Sort of speedy trial provision, huh?
There you go. Yes.
Of course, it's opposite thereof.
Chair Greenlick, relative to page 3, lines 19 through 22, I could get information for you if you'd like to know how many cases that we've had to pull off our website as a result of that. Prior to Senate Bill 337 last session, we did have all the claims that we had gotten on our website, but you may recall that we also weren't getting all of the reports as well, and we know that's been cleared up.
I remember quite well, yeah. Would you have serious problems? If this were the only part of the bill, would this cause you serious problems on behalf of the board?
Chair Greenlick, no.
Thank you. I might have a problem with one of my colleagues, but other than that. Okay, is there anything else? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3175. I saw Representative Riley lurking before. Can we?
And Krieger.
Is he nearby?
Yeah.
Okay. Would you get him? And we'll stand at ease for a moment.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
Krieger was hanging out as well. I don't know what he was here for, but
we're standing at ease. Please. Have you seen the fiscal on this?
Yep.
Can I comment on it?
I will.
Please, sir.
Okay. For the record, Mr. Chair, Wayne Krieger, State Rep District 1. Thank you for the opportunity to come and talk to you today.
House Bill 2925 would allow your doctor to prescribe and require an insurer to allow a 90-day supply prescription that you could actually pick up at your drugstore, not just by mail order. And you can currently, on many of these drugs, get that supply through mail order. And many rural Oregonians get their 90-day supply through the mail order program, and they actually have to go after it because they don't have it delivered to the house, so they still have to make a trip someplace to get it. My wife and I use the same drug for our high blood pressure, and I started having to take that when I became a legislator. So maybe
connection. And we ordered. State policeman didn't require you.
No, I didn't have any high blood pressure. It was real low. On one occasion, our supplier could fill mine, but she could only fill half of my wife's prescription, which was the same one. When we went to pick up mine, hers was ready, but we couldn't get hers because it was 2 days short of the time that the insurer would pay for it. So consequently, we had to go back and make another trip to the pharmacy to get the extra meds, and now we're still out of sequence. I don't know how we get back unless we get a half order someplace. And oftentimes, we don't know where we're going to be. Are we going to be in Salem? Are we going to be in Gold Beach? Am I going to be out of town for any length of time? And as I said before, many rural Oregonians don't live near the place that has discount drugs that they can mail order from or go pick them up. This bill would cut down on the amount of people waiting in lines each day and long-distance calls and travel, and help those limited income that have their copay. Now, it isn't infrequent when we go to pick it up at Walmart. If you just, depending what day it is, you may stand 20 minutes to a half an hour in two different lines trying to pick them up. They're that far behind. So it actually helped the pharmaceutical outlet because you'd be getting those for 90 days, only having to go in there one-fourth as often. As I said, it would simply allow a 90-day supply. Now, I did notice, you know, on the revenue thing, I'll read it, 4% increase of prescription drug waste due to medication changes. Is that any different if you pick it up compared to if it's mailed? That doesn't make any sense. Think about that. They're saying it's going to cost 4% more if you can pick it up a 90-day supply than if the same doctor, the same prescription, the same maintenance is mailed. That doesn't hold water at all. Just think about that a minute. Then down below, allows for a 90-day prescription drug benefit through mail-order prescription drugs. Yep. I've been taking the same one, as I said, since I came in the legislature. And when it's a maintenance drug, the type of thing that normally doesn't go away, diabetes, high blood pressure, and there's some other things that pretty much become a maintenance drug, then I see absolutely no reason, and if we have to amend the bill some way, fine, but those things that are a maintenance drug that you're going to be taking the rest of your life, that you could get a 90-day supply mailed, why can't you allow that person to pick it up at the drugstore? I cannot understand that. That's all I have.
Thank you. Let's have Representative Riley, and then we can ask both these gentlemen any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. For the record, Chuck Riley, state representative for Hillsborough, Corneas, and Forest Grove. I just wanted to weigh in on this a little bit myself because even though I don't have a long wait in line at Bi-Mart, where I get mine, I still have the same problem with maintenance drugs, my high blood pressure medicine, which I now have to take since I've been in the legislature.
I think we should put on the record this may be a function of age rather than
it's quite possible, Mr. Chair.
Older than I am.
He is.
Yeah.
It's, so am I.
It's, yes.
Not by much.
Not by much. At any rate, I have a problem when I'm on the road. I have a motor home, as many of you know, and we actually occasionally take a trip in it. And when I took my last trip that I had time to take, I did a trip that was 5 weeks long. And that created a bit of a problem for me. They don't have Bi-Marts in Louisiana. They don't have Bi-Marts in Illinois. There's places where I made a big circuit of the country, and a 30-day supply wasn't enough. So I need to find a way to make sure that we're able to do that. We're able to actually travel for 5 weeks without having to come back home and get my medication. So that's really all I wanted to say, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Yes. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. As a legislator who's been taking high blood pressure medicine as long as I've been in the legislature as well.
And yours is clearly not a function of age.
I think I'm younger than these guys.
Yeah,
my question to these guys is, I've got to imagine that some other state has done this before Oregon, because it's a common sense thing to do. Have you had any feedback on that, other people doing it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Brunt, I have not. I have not looked into what other states are doing, and I intend to do that.
Yes, sir.
No,
I didn't hear you grunting yet.
Well, Representative Ken and I decided to come up with alternative ways of expressing ourselves.
Mr. Chair, we're going to do that with a puppy mill bill. We're going to just bark. Yes or no?
It's not a mandate that the provider give you a 90-day supply. It's an option.
For the provider. Yeah. Provider can write a prescription for 90 days.
Right. Correct. And maybe Bi-Mart isn't the best pharmacy. If you're going to travel around the country, maybe you need to pick Walmart. That's a ubiquitous pharmacy around the country, and you can go from Walmart to Walmart.
I prefer not to do that, Mr. Vice Chair.
Okay. Well, I'm just saying it's an option, but it puts the hometown retail pharmacist at a huge disadvantage. And I'm looking at this $2.5 million potential. To me, is very speculative, and assuming that every prescription is filled for 90 days, and I don't quite see how we get there.
There are two different things here. I mean, my doctor, I'm going away for 90 days. My doctor can write a prescription for 90 days. The problem is that your health insurance might not cover.
That's right.
That's the issue. That's the issue.
It might cover. It might say, yeah, we'll fill the whole thing, and the first 30 days are covered by health insurance, and you pay cash for the other. For the other 6 months. And I think the other thing is that some systems tend to use the 90-day supply to encourage people to use mail-order pharmacies rather than, and that's the sort of bonus they get if you're willing to have your...
Well, it's an issue of copays also.
Yes.
Do we have a retail pharmacist going to talk on this?
No, we have a representative of...
Well, because the retail pharmacy...
They would charge the copay in each month.
Well, but there's a smaller copay for the mail order 90-day supply and a larger copay for the 30-day, and it's used as a...
Sometimes it is. We have a current pharmacy expert, well, sort of current. Representative Thompson, do you have a comment on this one?
Yeah, I'm having real problems with this fiscal. It doesn't make any sense, especially when there are numerous insurance companies trying to drive their customers to mail-order pharmacies on a 90-day rotation. If it cost a whole lot more to do that, they certainly wouldn't be doing it. In a lot of pharmacies, particularly small, independently owned ones, you're going to pay a dispensing fee each time you get the prescription filled. And it doesn't cost any more to fill a 90-day prescription, nor are you charged more than it does a 30-day prescription. So that has to be a cost savings to get 3 months at one operation, even though you're buying in advance.
Frequently they charge you three copays.
But if you go in on a 30-day basis, you're going to pay a copay every time.
I mean, if you go in the 90-day basis. If you have a $5 copay, and you get a 90-day supply, depending on your coverage, you'll end up paying three $5 copays.
I have never seen that. I'm not saying it couldn't be done, but as a rule, I don't believe it's customary to do that.
Mr. Chair, I want to read one thing I didn't read on here. I talked about the 90-day, the 4% increase they talk about due to loss of waste due to medication changes that occur in the 90-day period. Then they say, and prescription drug costs for enrollees who drop insurance coverage within the 90 days. Here again, Does it matter how you got it, whether you're going to drop it or not? I mean, evidently the guy that did this, I got to find out who wrote this. I'm hoping he doesn't get his step increase.
I think that's not a danger right now. I mean, it is really weird, but the only way we can deal with a weird fiscal is if we want to, is to send it to Ways and Means with a suggestion.
Yeah.
We think this fiscal is fantasy land. I mean, there isn't anything we can do about it.
I understand that.
And with this fiscal, it means we need to send it to Ways and Means, even though there's not a Ways and Means subsequent on it. So we need to figure out how we're going to do that.
Yes, just a final point on this fiscal, at least my final point on this. If you look at the $3.12 million estimated for OMEP, compare that with $2.5 million estimated for OEB. Now, I understand OMEP are higher cost utilizers. Nevertheless, it's a pool that's, what, 1/100th the size of OEB. So it's much, much smaller, but yet it would cost OMEP more than it would cost OEB, according to this fiscal.
I don't know. Relative size can't be that much, is it?
It's a lot.
Yeah. Representative Kotek.
Mr. Chair, we can't ask them to redo this if we all think it's spurious.
You bet. Sure you can. We've done it.
You bet.
Yeah.
All right. I would be very happy.
I don't know. I mean,
this just seems so weird. It's
very creative. It's interesting.
Very creative. Very creative.
Well, I don't think we know enough to know if this makes sense. I mean, I would love to know how they came up with the 4% waste issue that's in the written testimony from Regents. I mean, I just don't know. I'm like, how did you come up with that? How did you figure out that there's... I don't know. There's just so many questions about this fiscal.
Yeah, well, if that's something we can do, I would be most happy to do that. Well, we've got a little more testimony, but we'll close the hearing and see whether we can get them to rethink it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's see. Mr. Dewey, would you like to share with us ODS's perspective, please?
Well, maybe he has answered.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Mike Dewey representing the ODS plans. The bill is not clear to us. We do have, with regard to ODS, an option for 90-day mail order. And that's basically to save cost in the system. The issue, quite frankly, and I haven't seen the fiscal, part of the concern that we would have is that if you go to 90-day retail and that becomes somewhat popular, arguably, and I haven't looked at this that closely, arguably the cost on mail order could go up because their volume goes down in terms of economies of scale. So there is an issue as to what impact that would have. There is the issue of waste. I don't know what that number is, but there is the issue of waste on 90 days. I would not suspect, now the specialty drugs are problematic for us in this bill on 90 days in the sense that they are very costly and oftentimes, and a physician may not provide for 90 days, but if they did, oftentimes you may have a reaction to it. There may be another alternative in terms of how you are getting along. And as we all know, and you've had this discussion, those costs for the specialty drugs can be $1,200, you know, for a 30-day supply, for example. So that would be an issue for us. I don't know how we take care of that in this particular bill. We looked at it from the numbers. Now, these are the numbers that were given to me, that with regard to if you took specialty drugs out of the mix, the increase in cost on the premium side would be
0.96%.
2%.
2% of the whole. Oh, 0.2%.
0.96%. So almost 1%. If you have
the total cost of
that would be an increase. That would be an increase in your. No, that would be an increase in your overall premiums.
1%.
And in. As you know, prescription drugs are, you know, a pretty significant component of the dollar that we all pay percentage-wise. If you have specialty drugs in the mix, it's 1.58%. That is the numbers that our actuary provided to me today. We're happy to have the conversation on how to best do this, but it may have some unintended consequences. It would have an impact on on OEB and others that we manage. I do understand the concern, but again, our policy is that you have the option of 90 days mail order. And this bill is, again, a little bit ambiguous in the sense that I think we probably would meet that under the statute, Section 2 today. I mean, I think we would comply with it, but I don't think that was the intent of the sponsor of the bill.
Mike, help me understand. It must clearly not cost you money to do 90 days by email. It must save you money. I mean, by mail. Email would be even better.
Yeah. Email saves a lot of money.
90 days by mail, if it saves you money, why would it cost you maybe an extra 10% on your prescriptions costs to allow it to happen in a drugstore as opposed to by mail?
Mr. Chair, the thinking is that if you have the opportunity to get a 90-day supply retail, you're not going to mail. Mm-hmm. And if you don't go to mail, over time, they lose market share. And so their costs...
They being?
The mail order pharmacy. Their economies of scale. I mean, if we want to drive as because of the cost, and Representative Thompson understands this, in terms of just kind of lowering the health care costs, we want to drive, if we could, many people to mail order.
Because it's cheaper to do it by mail order?
It is.
It costs less?
It costs less.
To do it by mail order?
Yes, it does.
Do the PBMs own the mail order pharmacies?
I can't answer that question. I don't know exactly who.
If I could chime in there, it's all over the place. Well Partner that does the business for state of Oregon is independently owned. Walmart has a mail order component. I believe Fred Meyer has a mail order component. There are a number of pharmacy corporations that own mail order as part of their component. Kaiser has something like that. I would think it would not be PBM dominated. So.
Michael? Chair, yeah, thanks. I've been using mail order for a long time, and I think I was first lured into it because of the lower copay. You know, I think we maybe paid for 2 months of copay and got 3 months supply, right. Something like that. And then once I got used to it, it became very convenient. I really prefer going that way. But I'm wondering, as the actuaries came up with the figures that you provided, Mike, were they assuming that it would be one, that the person going into the pharmacy would be paying one copay, or were they thinking in terms of three copays? Because if there was still, you know, an advantage to the person, they might still prefer to do the mail order, and it may be then less of a disincentive to mail order.
Mr. Chair and Representative Demereau, I don't think it's there. I think it's on we've got mass quantities of prescriptions out there, and so it also gets to if you lose your 90-day supply in the first 3 weeks or whatever, you've got to go back, you get another 90-day supply. So the more people that have 90-day supplies in the system, there is the potential for just increased cost overall. I don't know how.
But you want that for mail order.
Well,
isn't the same thing true in mail order?
It would be true, but once you start to get to retail, then there's a market shift at that point in time, and that's the concern that we have is that market shift, notwithstanding what's best. I mean, again, we're talking about what's best for the patient. You know, and we have sometimes a conflict here in terms of it's a lot easier for me to go to my Walmart or Rite Aid as opposed to I don't want to do mail order. I just don't trust it. But there are just thousands of prescriptions out there. Now, again, how they got to the number and what math they used and what formula they used, logarithm, I don't know. That's the number I have presented to me, but I'm very happy to sit down with Representative Krieger and others to do, to provide some additional information with the people that know how this works.
Mr. Dewey, you've been reading bills for a long time. Will you read that Section 2?
again carefully. Then let me ask you a question.
Sure. A policy or certificate of health insurance.
I mean, just read it yourself. You don't need it.
Okay.
Is there anything in that section that says ODS could say, fine, we cover 90-day supply, here's how you get it. Use our mail order.
The way I read the bill, we could, Mr. Chair, we could say that. That is not the intent, though, of the sponsors. I believe they would like to have the option at retail for the 90 days. It would require, that's where they're coming from, and so that's why I address that.
Representative Thompson?
I think one of the clarifying things about this bill is how it would most likely be used. Because we're really talking about long-term reoccurring prescriptions for people in chronic care, which is a huge part of the population. You would not use this for a 15-day supply of antibiotics or, you know, some kind of an ointment for a short-term problem. That would all go to the local pharmacy. So we're talking about a class of trade here and how it would impact them as opposed to just everything, because I don't think there would be a case where it would make sense for everybody to use mail order for everything.
I don't think a doctor would write you a 90-day supply.
Exactly.
For a drug
that's the other part. Most often, if a doctor is going to try you as a new blood pressure patient on a medication, they'll give you a trial prescription. You try that, you get the dosage adjusted, then you'd end up going to a 90-day supply. So there are applications of this that wouldn't reflect an application for everybody at every time that would make sense. I mean, the kind of things that Representative Krieger and Representative Riley were talking about are, in their particular cases, as I happen to be one of those legislators on blood pressure medication, too. I wonder what that correlation is. But, it's a longer-term sort of event. And in my particular case, it was a cost savings to go to a 90-day supply mail order over what I could do at the local pharmacy. But
Representative Hannah, we're almost done with this one.
And again, if we put some parameters around it, but again, the way I read the bill today, we comply. But that wasn't what I thought the sponsors intended.
It would be useful for you to get us some of those numbers. It would be very interesting to see those, and that might give us some reason to ask the LFO office to rethink this.
We're happy to do that,
Mr. Chair. I just have trouble with the fiscal is it's based on what people think the sponsors intended, not what the bill says.
Yeah.
And I think there's a huge delta here.
Yeah.
Because the bill doesn't require it, doesn't say the copay has to be the same. You could have a significant copay difference between a 30 and a 90-day supply. I think
it's complicated. There's no question about
it. I would argue the way the bill reads that ODS would say,
thank you.
Here's how you get your 90-day supply.
Well, the only thing I'd say
is, if we want to do something different, we need to have language that says something.
Yeah, the only thing we feel obligated here, sitting here, to let the sponsors know this bill doesn't do what you think it does, and it passes, and they go, what happened? And we don't want that to happen.
Well, as we said in the previous bill, we specialize in unintended consequences. That's our biz. Representative Kinnemer?
No, I think you just made my point. I don't think the bill does what the sponsors intend.
Yeah.
We ought to let them know that.
Or go with this one and make it clear that this is one way to meet the problem. I mean, I suppose Representative Riley's testimony would have been a problem because as he was winding around, he wouldn't have had an address to deliver it to. But I think in Representative Krieger's, it would have met his need if he could have done it by mail.
I think Representative Riley just needs to spend more money in Oregon during this time.
There are many of his constituents that think it's better when he's out of the state.
I won't go there.
Thank you very much. We close the public hearing. I think we will ask LFO to take another look at that fiscal, which seems a little odd to us. We'll ask the sponsors to take a look at the bill
and
see if it does what they want and it's cared for, and I expect we'll hear about it again. Let's open up a public hearing on House Bill 3349 and ask Representative Hannon to join us. With anybody you want to bring to protect you?
Not unless you plan on picking on me.
No, no way.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are you ready?
Please.
Okay. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members, colleagues. My name is Bruce Hanna. I'm a state representative from House District 7. I'm here this afternoon to provide a short history on school-based health clinics and to provide you with information regarding the intent of House Bill 3349. As you may know, school-based health centers are a national model designed to ease access to health care by reducing barriers that have historically prevented adolescents from seeking the health services they need, including the inconvenience, the cost, the transportation concerns, concerns around confidentiality, and apprehension about discussing personal health problems with adults. The practitioners in school-based health clinics provide a full range of services for all students, regardless of whether or not they have health insurance coverage. The centers provide health care access to more than 39,000 students. During the 2007-2008 school year, nearly 21,000 students received services, visiting over 69,000 times to these clinics. This included more than $1.2 million in health care services to uninsured students. It is also important to note that in rural areas, these health centers provide services to siblings, families, and other community members as well, providing a rural health access. Part of the funding for school-based health centers comes through DHS general funds, which are then transferred to local public health authorities using a formula that provides four different tiers of funding based on the number of certified school-based health clinics in a county. I know that gets a little technical, but I'll give you a little more of that history, but just remember there is a formula there. Additionally, funding is received through schools, school districts, county health departments. In many cases, hospitals in local communities contribute to those clinics, other community providers, local business sponsors and individuals, and then grants and grant funding. Oregon currently has 44 school-based health clinics located in 19 counties, both urban and rural, and unfortunately we closed one clinic last year. Over the past several years, I have been supporting and have supported the efforts by DHS to expand the number of school-based health clinics in our state. However, House Bill 3349 will address the need to strengthen the sustainability of our existing school-based health clinics during the very difficult economic times and to protect the vital service they provide. I have had prepared, and I believe you have a copy of the Dash 1 amendment to correct the original draft. Our intent through the Dash 1 is to
Let's see if we do.
Okay.
Do we have?
We do. Yes.
Okay.
I believe you do.
Thank you.
Our intent through the Dash 1 is to continue the current funding established, the current funding formula established by DHS, and require any new funds to be directed to supporting the existing school-based health clinics, which are struggling, rather than expanding on the number of clinics. Under this proposal, it would allow DHS to distribute the additional funds based on the number of clients served by the existing clinics. So I'm asking for your support of House Bill 3349 with the Dash 1 amendment, and that it would be sent to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. And I do appreciate the opportunity to testify in front of you and would welcome questions if I can help you with that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, we not only have the Dash 1s, we have a Hannon Gross version of it with the Dash 1s in it.
Questions, Representative Hannon?
Yeah, I have a question, Mr. Chair.
Thanks.
Representative, the clinic that closed last year, was it? Where was it? And would this legislation then prevent that center from reopening anytime soon?
Let me get a little help on the location. Thank you.
Great.
Jared Greenlake, Jim Keller, policy analyst for the House Republican Office. Representative Demo, I believe it was in Clackamas County, and I don't know enough of the details whether or not this would have, in fact, saved that clinic or not. This happened almost a year ago.
But, excuse me, Mr. Chair, so if this would say that any additional funds would go to the already existing clinics, then if that clinic is not no longer existing, then they couldn't reopen, as it were.
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's correct.
I'm sorry. What's?
No, I just wondered, who else do we have that might be able to answer that question?
We have some folks that can help with that. But maybe you can help me. I thought I understood the original bill. I'm having a little trouble understanding Section 1.1 of the amended version. And it says something about the department shall, at a minimum, provide funding to counties based on a formula in effect on December 31st, 2009.
Well, that's the current funding formula.
Unless it's changed between now and 2009, is that?
Yeah.
Or was that supposed to be 2008?
No, we're not proposing to change the actual formula. This would be for the additional funds so that those clinics that are open would receive the additional funding based on the number of clients they serve. So that's the additional piece.
But the first piece says DHS has to provide at a minimum funds based on a formula that is in effect 7 months from now or 8 months from now.
Which line, Mr. Chair?
That would be line 4. Well, but it's first three, 2 through 4 is what I'm having trouble understanding. I mean, does that force them to provide more money than they're providing now? Or?
I don't know.
Based on that funding formula? And what is that funding formula?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure why that date got put there.
Mr. Chair, the funding formula right now, like if you have 1 to 2 school-based health clinics in a given county, they'll get, if you have one, they'll get $60,000. If there's two, they each get $30,000. And then it goes up in increments, and I don't recall all the increments. I'm not sure why the drafter put that particular date in there, but we're referencing the formula that's in place right now.
Well, I've heard rumors that we may have a financial problem facing us. And I wonder if what this would do would be to say we can't reduce the amount of money that DHS is now providing for school health things. I mean, I wouldn't mind doing that, but I want to make sure whether, I mean, it could say one of two things. It could say, you have a formula now, keep spending that much. If you spend more than that much, here's what you do with the excess. That's part two of this, but I wonder the effect of part one is what, I mean, whether it would bind us in some way.
Mr. Chair, I think since it says if in part two, it's not directing, I mean, it's not saying you couldn't change. It says if the department provides the funding.
No, I understand the excess.
Yeah.
I'm worried about shall at a minimum provide funding, which it says on line 3.
Mr. Chair, I think you're reading that right. I would be thrilled about setting a maintenance of effort floor and saying we have to make sure we're spending a certain amount every year for school-based health centers. But that's how I read Section 1.
Mr. Chair, part of my confidence with this was based on that, looking at the reductions that DHS has proposed in the event that they have to do a 30% reduction, and school-based health clinics weren't on that list. So my assumption from that, of course, was that they'd continue.
Change. Okay, well, we'll explore that a little more. Yes, Representative Thompson?
Notwithstanding our statewide funding problems, how does this affect the ability of to open new clinics in new communities? Is it effective? I mean, plus, minus, not at all? What?
Not at all.
Well, I'm assuming in my own district there's a need to open at least one more in another community. Would it have any effect on that?
I believe it would have an effect during this time period. because what happens is the funding formula that there is, as Jim described, 60,000 for one, you cut that in half for two, and then it builds slightly after that, and I don't have that formula with me. The issue is that those clinics, which are most efficient, typically are seeing more patients outside of just the school-based clinic. And so if there was additional funding for the clinics that are currently open, that rather than dividing that equally, that it would be divided out to those clinics which are seeing more patients.
Yeah.
And that's what we're trying to get to is that rather than just saying here's equal math for everybody, let's get the funding to the clinics that are actually seeing the greatest number of patients.
Why did you change the original wording then? Because I think that said that very clearly. That's what I thought we were trying to get to.
Well, as you know, Mr. Chair, drafting is a...
I know. It's an arcane effort.
It is a tough effort.
Speaking with somebody that has a 1,000-page amendment in front of them, I understand the situation.
We were trying to keep it short and simple, and thus the quarter-page piece, and... that's why we have good committees like these that you bring the idea.
Look at them.
You know what we're trying to do is provide a level of service and reward those clinics that are actively out there helping people both in the community and the students, and get them the funding when they're seeing lots of folks. Maybe we've got to make some adjustments to the language, and I'm very
we'll
willing to
do
that. The idea is...
But that is your objective, right? Your objective is that we're distributing money in a county and X dollars is going into this county and there are two or more clinics. You distribute the money based on the number of patients they see.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay.
We'll try to figure
out how to get that
we're
in
trying.
Place.
All right. Yeah.
Thank you. We've got some more testimony. We'll see if they can help us with
Thank
this
you.
Conundrum. We have Jackie Rose, please. Robert Nystrom. We also going to get Catherine in this one, too? Always happy to see you.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlake and members of the Health Care Committee. My name is Jackie Rose. I'm a former school-based health care nurse practitioner, a board member of the Oregon School-Based Health Care Network, and designee to the current funding formula work group. And I want to thank you very much for this opportunity to talk to you about House Bill 3349. And first of all, I want to say how very appreciative and grateful we are to Representative Hannity for his support for school-based health services. We are very, very grateful. We also want to mention, however, and talk about that we know the intention of this bill is to help achieve sustainability for school-based health centers and to improve the process by which funds are distributed statewide to school-based health centers. And we completely agree with those principles. However, we are concerned about the possibility of some unintended consequences from the way this legislation is written, and also concerned that it may unnecessarily complicate an agreed-upon funding formula work group, which is currently charged with improving the existing school-based health center funding formula. I want to say one of the great benefits of the school-based health center model that's important to keep in mind is the time that school-based health center personnel take with students to address their issues, open the channels of communication, and understand what the real health issues and risk behaviors are. And basing funding just simply on the number of clients served at a site does not necessarily adequately reflect the diversity of school-based health centers and their programs statewide. And that's why we do believe it's important to keep some level of local control over how dollars are allocated. And this is because school-based health centers differ in their size, sponsorship, geographic location, number of insured students, et cetera, among counties. One of the concerns we have is that the way House Bill 3349 is set up, that it might end up rewarding the larger school-based health centers located in larger metropolitan areas at the expense of some of the more rural counties. It might benefit those centers that have been in existence for some time over some of the newer ones that have just started up that are still establishing their credibility within their school community and doing their marketing to bring the students in. And also issues of where there are sometimes workforce shortages temporarily or weather-related issues that affect the hours of operation in a given year, then the numbers might be less and the school-based health center reimbursement might be affected for subsequent sessions. What I want you to know is that we currently have a funding formula work group that is meeting right now to address some of the inequities in the school-based health center funding formula. A couple of things that I want to clarify. One, the school-based health center that closed was closed because the school that it was located in was condemned. That's the one that you were asking about earlier.
Where was that?
That was, I believe, in Jackson County. And they're doing, I believe it was one of the ones in Jackson County, one of the elementary schools. And you can correct me if I'm wrong on that one. The current funding formula that was referred to was established in 2004 by a similar collaborative effort statewide by stakeholders in school-based health centers who understand the diversity. And at that time, the funding formula was adjusted to take the set amount of money that was allocated for school-based health centers and to make it most equitable without jeopardizing any centers from closing. And the result of applying that those principles at that point in time resulted in the step formula. 1 to 2 centers, a county got $60,000. 3 to 5, they got $120,000. 6 to 9, they got $180,000. And 10 or more, they got $240,000. At that time, when that formula went in, it was effective. No school-based health centers were closed, and we shifted from the previous funding model that was established before certification, where those who had originally applied for grants in the early 80s and early 90s got the funding, and no one else that came online afterwards got any. I always refer to it as water rights. And so we were able then in 2004 to shift it to a new level. Since then, as people have come to appreciate this model, and as this model has become more firmly recognized and valued to be truly an access model for youth, money has been appropriated for expansion, which then raises the new issues we find. If you go from one center to two centers, you're a center that had been getting $60,000, then has to share that. And this is well recognized. And when that group in 2004 established the formula, they recognized there would be issues again, and it was written into it that we would reconvene, which is what we have done right now. And it's a well-represented group represented by all factions of the school-based health center community who understand these issues statewide and are working on numerous formulas right now. The challenge, of course, is to attain equity with limited dollars and not jeopardize centers from closing, recognizing that there are tremendous differences. Those centers that serve the most students are typically in the larger schools. So we have some rural centers where the providers have to travel an hour and a half, 2 hours, just to get to the center to operate it for the core hours. And some rural areas have fewer students so that they couldn't attain those higher numbers. So these are the issues that we share together statewide as we work to address the issues of inequity and revise the formula. I'm going on a little bit more, but my main point with this is that we will be establishing a new funding formula that takes into account some of the current problems that have evolved with the expansion component. And we're somewhat concerned that by adding in another layer on the funding formula for the new dollars, that may limit our ability to reach the best solutions.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. And if you have any questions, I'm happy to entertain those.
Let's do the whole panel, and then we'll have questions.
Thank you, Chair Greenlee. My name is Catherine Bradley, and I'm the administrator for the Office of Family Health, which has the school-based health center program in it. You have testimony before you, and I am speaking in opposition to House Bill 3349. We do want to also acknowledge at the beginning how much we do appreciate Representative Hanna's work in support of school-based health centers. The school-based health center process really does rest on funding formulas and our ability to be responsive to funding formulas and to changes in the environment. We are aware that there's a lot of concern currently with our school-based health centers and the difficulty about whether the focus is on sustainability or expansion. We do believe that we have a process that's in place that really sort of brings the right partners together, such as Jackie was identifying. We actually are in the process, as she identified, of simply pulling together a new group to review them. Representative Greenlee spoke earlier of the arcane nature of developing bills. There's also the arcane nature of also funding formulas. For any of you that have been involved in them, there are multiple ways and aspects that we have to look at. I was referring to Bob Nystrom earlier, and I told him when Family Planning did their last formula revision 3 years ago, we did 17 different versions trying to take into account different issues and variables that we wanted to consider. And after looking at many multiple versions that were responsive to county concerns, we actually ended up with four key elements that we thought addressed the multiplicity of need. And again, I think that's part of the core of funding formulas, is that it's a multivariate issue that we have to address. We probably need to visit it every couple of years in response to the economy, and to have something that is addressed and defines it within bill or within statute really does make it fairly problematic to be flexible to respond to the economy. The other thing that we wanted to raise really was addressed by the earlier speaker, but we do occasionally get additional funds, which I'll ask Bob Nystrom to speak of, through grants and those sort of opportunities, and we would be concerned that they would essentially be driven by simply the largest volume what is produced. This is not a model that's intended to be simply economy-based. We are trying to find different ways to fund these models. We're trying to find more creative solutions. In communities that really want to use them for a community process, we want to be able to honor that, but we recognize there are communities that choose not to do that. We're also very concerned about high school versus elementary school issues, and inevitably in those communities that have school-based health centers in both their high schools and elementary schools, the larger volume is always in the high school. And in a situation such as that, for example, in Josephine County, where they currently have two school-based health centers, using this approach, the high school would get 70% of the funding, the elementary school would get 30% of the funding, and subsequently put the elementary school into jeopardy. So again, we appreciate the issues that are being raised here. We do recognize they're in response to the current environment, and we would ask actually that you do not support this bill and leave us to work within the current process and with the current partners. Thank you very much. Bob Nystrom is with me today. He is the manager of the School-Based Health Center program, and Bob can speak to some of the other funding and is also available to speak to some of the specific and questions you might have.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlee, members of the committee.
For the record, my name is Bob Nystrom, and I manage the adolescent health section in the public health division, which includes the management of the school-based health center program. I, too, would want to thank Representative Hanna for his interest in sustaining school-based health centers. It was this program that actually brought me to public health nearly to the date 15 years ago, and I've been able to watch that program grow and nurture it during that course in time. And the funding of the centers has always been a core issue, and we continue to work on that in a number of different directions, and one of them Jackie Rose has spoken to with the current funding formula committee that's in operation. Let me give you two examples of where the unintended consequences of simply a client-based distribution of funds would not work. One of them is in-house, where in the last biennium, our immunization program approached us and asked if they could do a project within the school-based health centers to increase the immunization rates of basically middle school populations. In doing so, they wanted to distribute some funds to centers that were interested in a project like this, and it was a quality improvement type of project, a process improvement kind of project, which was meant to work on their individual systems, their outreach, et cetera, to focus on the rates of one or more immunizations. The essence of that kind of project is that the amount of clinician time or planning time, whether it's in a school, elementary school of 146 kids or in a school-based health center that's serving 2,000 or 3,000 in a large high school is the same in terms of working on some of those quality improvement processes. So this sort of distribution formula, when we had those monies available, would probably have been a real disincentive if only a small amount of dollars were available to those smallest schools to work on something like a QA process. Another example from the last biennium is we were able to identify some additional end-of-year monies that we wanted to make certain that went out into our special payments to counties. And in consultation with some of our partners, the interest was in really helping promote the professional development of the clinicians who are working in a fairly specialized field in terms of trying to deliver adolescent developmentally appropriate services. And in that case, we were able to distribute amount of dollars equal to each center to promote one or more clinicians to continue to do some targeted professional development.
Were these independent of the existing formula?
These decisions would be independent of the existing formula.
So it is possible to do that. That's not the issue in this
We
bill,
currently
right?
do that now in sense of involving our stakeholders when dollars come to us.
But that's not the issue in this bill. This bill is talking about excess general funds.
That's not clear to me in the current piece of legislation.
Well, I don't see how special funds would not be handled in a different way.
Chair Greenlee and committee, the way we were interpreting the amendment was that it actually wasn't specific just to general funds but could be to any other funds. And so it did raise the opportunity that we've been able to use funding sources to do some of these other targeted developments. The point being that currently when we do have funds available or there are excess funds, we work with our partners to identify a formula.
Outside of the formula.
Outside of the formula,
yeah,
yes, sir.
I think that's... Right. When is the group going to report on the new formula?
The group is in the throes of it right now. In fact, we had a meeting this morning, and we started the end of January reviewing all of the concerns that everyone statewide had and taking those concerns back and creating scenarios. We right now have we have 9 plus different scenarios that the three of us...
Excuse me. Let me try my question a different way.
I'm sorry.
When is the group going to be prepared to report the new formula?
The target date is in May.
Thank you. Are there any legislative people involved in that process at all?
No. Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Chair. First off,
in the Josephine County example, I think, would be inappropriate since the school-based health clinics are run by the same people. So it doesn't matter who gets the money. It's run by an FQHC. So, in fact, I think there are three school-based health clinics in Josephine County, one at the elementary school, one at the middle school, and one at the high school. Evergreen, the middle or elementary school, was just opened. Unless it's changed, they didn't tell me.
Chair Greenlich, Representative Maurer, there is an elementary school-based health center that has opened and yet not been certified and is expected to be certified by June 30th of this year.
Okay, certification. Okay.
And Chair Greenlich and Representative Maurer, I'd like to address the example. It is true that in some counties, all the school-based health centers have the same medical sponsor, but in other counties, we have multiple medical sponsors, some of which are FQHCs, some of which are not. So the very nature of the model itself is quite creative, and the ability for a local public health department to in local decision-making to occur on what's the best distribution of funds based on types of medical sponsorship and those sorts of factors becomes crucial.
Except I thought you were creating a statewide formula.
We are creating a statewide formula which would make available funds more equitably down to the county level, but we still are attempting to achieve, as one of our principles in the funding formula group, a degree of local decision-making.
Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I stepped down, and I apologize if this was mentioned, but, you know, until we established the current formula, we didn't have a formula here in the state, and dollars that were distributed were basically, there was a set of centers who got state funding because they had basically been around a long time, and half of them didn't. And a few years ago, when the state sat down with the stakeholders and said, we have to have some kind of equalization of funding across all the centers statewide, they sat down and worked it out. Now they're in phase two of looking at it again. It's very complicated, lots of different stakeholders. I personally wouldn't want to be involved because I think the meetings would probably be endless. But I'm just saying, I trust these folks to do the right thing. And while I also really am excited about Representative Hanna's interest in school-based health centers, I'm not quite sure what problem we're trying to solve here in the writing of the LC draft, because centers could mean a school, they could mean a medical. I mean, this is just confusingly written. I'm not sure what we're trying to solve. So I just want to, if we could maybe get some clarification between the now and if there's another hearing on it.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. There's one last question. It just the Oregon School-Based Health Care Network is based out of Washington.
Representative Greenlich and Representative Maurer, I am here, Jackie Rose, as a board member, and I happen to live in Washougal, Washington, and that is my testimony and my address.
Okay. Okay. So it's not the organization. It's just where. Okay.
Thank you. All right. Thank you very much. We will close that public hearing on 3349. The whole committee's here. Is that right? Yeah. Let me tell you where. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about where we're going with 2009. And also, I opened up. Before several of you were here, I opened up a public hearing and closed the public hearing on House Bill 2116. I know what?
We stop this one.
We can ignore it.
Sorry, what's your question?
We do stop.
Yeah, I know.
No, we can ignore it.
No, we're not going to ignore it. Oh. Representative Bruin?
I do have a question about 2009.
If we're all together, let me simply say, the reason I opened a hearing on 2116 is if the decision is made to take the provider taxes out of 2009, 2016 will be the vehicle for those taxes. So we wanted to get it in process. The next session on 2016, if the decision is made to take the provider tax out, will be a work session on 2116, which will have the provider tax as a piece of it. So I just want to let you know what's going on there. You've all had access to the amendments on 2009. The recommendation is the substantive issues in those amendments, and we still think it's true, are in between page 6 and page 40. My intention on Wednesday is to adopt those dash 9 amendments into 2009, which is a gut and stuff of it. It is also possible that we'll have a few amendments to the amendment that are simply some wording things that didn't get straightened out as they went in. We're trying to find out if we can do that, but if we do, we will put the dash 9s on the table and then amend the dash 9s with another set of amendments that make little changes in it. Like, for example, the definition of the essential benefit package didn't get into this thing. It just got left out as we agreed it would, and it'll be to put those back on. Well, the intention is to adopt the dash 9s as amended into 2009 and send 2009 to the floor with a subsequent referral back to us. This is a complicated business. The bill will go to the floor with a subsequent referral back to us, which will allow then to get a engrossed version of 2009 for us to consider when we consider the last sets of amendments. So we'll be able to have amendments that go specifically to the bill. That will come back to us probably on the 13th, which won't allow us to deal with it on the 14th, but in order to hear the amendments that we intend to think about of the engrossed version, we're going to open a public hearing and then move to a work session and House Bill 2131. And 2131 will also have the dash 9 amendments for that bill, and we'll be working other amendments in the context of 2131, although the intention then will be to have those ready for us on the 15th to consider in relation to the A engrossed version of House Bill 2009. My intention is to move 2009 with the new amendments either on the 15th, I hope on the 15th or on the 17th, because we're running out of time as to when we can work bills, and that will clear the deck. So if this doesn't make a lot of sense to you, you're not alone. It doesn't necessarily make a lot of sense to me either, but it's what the Ledge Council, the Speaker's Office, and the Clerk's Office all have agreed is the way we need to handle it. Yes, sir.
My question is, I know you have amendments, and there's technical fixes, whatever. But where do the rest of us, what do we amend?
If you have amendments that you want to raise in addition to the amendments that I'm going to raise, you need to talk to the Legislative Council. I think the problem is that when we get to the formal thing, well, why don't we do this? We can vote on them in the context of the 2131. Is that the right number? The bill, yeah. And then if they're accepted at that point, then we'll rewrite them in the context of 2009 and move them in there.
Okay. Wow, now that's that is political cover.
Well, we can do it again in 2009 if you want. If it's defeated once, if it's accepted, then they'll be ready for the 2009. If they're defeated and you want to do it again for theater, we can do it again in 2009.
Okay.
Sure. Just a question. So
yes, sir.
It would be amended. It goes to the floor. It doesn't go to a floor vote. It gets re-referred. Is that
it? It just goes to the speaker. Yeah, they can't do a
they can't do an A engross until it's on its way to the floor,
yeah, I just didn't
even
know
though
that
it will go to the speaker's desk and then come back to us as soon as it...
But,
yeah, no, it will not. In that form, it will not be voted on. What's your question?
Sandy made copies for everyone.
Oh, we do have... Have you gotten printed copies of 1 through 40? We have those copies for you. You also got an email that said how to find them, and I hope you didn't print out the 1,000 pages of boilerplate. We still believe... Have we gotten through the whole 1,000 pages? Not yet. We've gotten through about half of them, and so far I have not found any policy things in those first half of those pages. We'll know in the next day or two. And if anybody else finds anything hidden in any of those that's looking at them, please let us know. But I think we have been assured there is nothing past page 40 except 1,000 sections of conforming amendments. But, I mean, there are 6 pages of statutes listed to start this thing. This is a... We think we have established a new record for the Legislative Council's office. And any of the memories of anybody there. But we've also only had to have 9 amendments drafted so far rather than what could have been 60 or 70. Okay, let's open a public hearing on House Bill 2850. And ask Representative Bruin to join us, please. Or to unjoin us, I guess.
Are you going to go down?
He's got my proxy.
You're welcome. You want to join?
Yeah, come on down.
I put you on the left side, didn't I? Aren't you the chief?
He'll always feel more comfortable on your left.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. I'm Scott Bruin, representing House District 37, and I think it's a great segue, Mr. Chair, to sort of preface this with discussion about House Bill 2009. As I testified on a different bill this morning at the Business and Labor Committee, trying to describe what we were doing here on the Healthcare Committee, I was describing 2009. I said, among other things, that it was big and bodacious, and I said there was many points of view on 2009, and I gave no estimates or forecasts on what it would look like or how it would end up. But I did say, and I think I can speak for the Healthcare Committee when I was speaking this morning, that we, regardless of how we feel about the various and sundry components of 2009, we all feel that whatever we do on this front is either doomed for failure or doomed for something less than success unless we can get our arms around costs. And so I, first of all, just want to applaud this committee, Mr. Chair, Representative Kotak, who's done a lion's share of the work on the... I don't think we have all the answers yet, but I think we all realize that getting our arms around costs are an integral part of 2009. That is sort of how we have arrived at 2850. Mr. Chair, you probably won't remember this. You didn't know my name at the time, but I was a new freshman representative back in 2005, and I approached you just because knowing that you were one of the health guys, and I approached you in the House lounge because I just read a big piece out of the Economist magazine that talked about medical information technology and interoperable healthcare records, and I thought it was the greatest thing since sliced Wonder Bread. And I said that I sort of, you know, knew what I knew, which was about this much to you, and you talked for about 10 minutes. You knew much more than I did, and basically you said that you're on the right track. So here we are 5 years later. And we have this bill in front of you, and just to briefly describe the bill, what the bill does is one part is sort of already being done, although it's still important, and the other part puts a finer point on it. The part that's already being done is establish a task force. The way we've defined the task force within the bill is to look exactly like the existing task force, which is the Health Information Infrastructure Advisory Committee that the governor put on, I think it was back in April of last year. So this bill does not try to reinvent the wheel with the task force. It would use that, or at least I think we should put on record that we mean the same thing to happen. The second and the most important piece for my position on this bill is that it actually puts a hard and fast date on when we need to have a statewide conformance, if you will, to or statewide mandate on all healthcare providers being ready to go on interoperable healthcare records, and that's December 15th, 2015. There's various, this task force, the HIIAC, has various dates and time in which it needs to report back to us, but really, if you're going to take away one point from this bill, it is December 15th, 2015. Everybody who provides healthcare in the state will be on systems that can, are compatible, and talk to each other. I think that interoperable medical records and health HIT in general are very important, and I just want to highlight, I've jotted down a few reasons. I'll go through them very quickly. First of all, to improve healthcare quality, to prevent medical errors, to increase administrative efficiencies, to reduce defensive medicine, and reduce the overconsumption of healthcare caused because health system A isn't necessarily talking to health system B or health system C and so on. To decrease paperwork, of course, to expand access to affordable care, and for improved tracking of chronic disease management, and to provide an evaluation of healthcare efficiencies due to the collection of comparable price and quality information. Those are a few of those. I've gotten big exclamation points, though the bottom line here is other than improve quality is to reduce costs. And once again, that's the take home from this, to reduce costs. I'm somebody, as a lot of the board knows, who has used quite a bit of healthcare in my life. And it's amazing. It's amazing that we have this incredible 21st century medical technology. We've got great providers, best providers in the world, from doctors and nurses. We've got great facilities. We've got great equipment. You know, it's Star Trek as far as the technology is concerned, yet we're using a Leave It to Beaver technology. I mean, we're using Leave It to Beaver 1950s health record technology. And I mean, even though we have faxes and emails, they use that. Most of my providers still carry around, every time I walk into their office, a big folio, this big, stuffed with paper. And they don't understand why the doctor in the other healthcare system isn't quite getting the message they're sending over to them. And I become the conduit for it. And that's fine. I can do that. But you ask yourself, where's the breakdown when that conduit is a lady who's 86 years old and may be forgetful, whatever the case may be. I think we're seeing a system breakdown. What happens, of course, is then you get more defensive medicine than you would normally because the doctors are trying to cover themselves, and you get overconsumption of healthcare. So those are just two of the cost drivers, not to mention just the glaring inefficiency. I will conclude by just saying what I think the task force would look at primarily as their helping to implement and reporting back to the legislature in prior to this December 15, 2015 date. Here's what I would see the task force doing. Provide updates on the plan so that all hospitals and healthcare providers have interoperable records, of course. They would look at updating the state health privacy laws to allow for record locator services and electronic submission of consent, among others. Discuss guidelines and penalties for misuse of patient records. And finally, to discuss the creation of a loan, not finally, but including discussion of creation of a loan or line of credit program to aid with implementation. Of course, that's going to be important for some of the smaller providers. Let me just close by using a phrase that we often use in the construction industry, which is, I don't work there now, but spent quite a few years of my life working in the construction industry, and this goes to the 2015 date. We talk about how important this is, and we've been talking about it for years, Mr. Chair, but we seem to keep pushing it off until getting it done. And so the quote we always used, or the line we always used in the construction industry, was simply, get her done. And that's what this bill does. It just says, get her done, and get her done by 2015. So I appreciate your indulgence. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Cannon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ben Cannon, State Representative from Portland. Just a couple of words to add to what Representative Bruin said. I think he's done a great job explaining the rationale for this bill, and I do come at it from a cost containment standpoint, and if I didn't believe that these systems offered the potential for great savings on cost, I wouldn't be supporting the bill. But I think that the way I come at this personally, like probably Representative Bruin and maybe others, is through personal experience and sort of the anecdotes related to not my own health care, but a member of my immediate family's. And the amount of time that her caregiver, she was fortunate to have one, spent lugging these records around to try to ensure that they wound up in the appropriate physician's hand, making sure that surgeon A saw the work that specialist B had done, because that, without him, her husband, carrying this stuff around. He didn't get it. And is this the entire solution to that problem? I'm not sure that it is. I think creating the electronic medical record doesn't guarantee, for instance, that the physicians will look at it or use it appropriately. Nevertheless, Representative Bruin said 1950s era. I think that's a perfect description of, and this is in some cases within the same hospital, of the challenge of trying to get records from the 8th floor to the 4th floor and systems that really didn't seem structured to support that. So I am hopeful, optimistic, and really appreciate Representative Bruin's work on this and hope that we can move forward in the way that he has suggested.
Questions? Do you have questions? Yes, please.
I really applaud what you're trying to do here, and I'm 100% supportive of moving to electronic records. I'm a little cautious about the 2015 date. The reason for that, I attended a conference last spring in Washington on electronic medical records, and the takeaway from that was twofold, that we're having a problem currently that the developers of the software programs are not communicating well with medical practitioners. So there's a translation error still in that system. Doctors don't write software. Software people don't practice medicine, and they apparently can't communicate very well either. And that's creating some problems, even though we have a number of systems like Kaiser and whatnot in place. The other one is that whatever system we develop nationally or within Oregon is sure to be challenged on the basis of confidentiality and security. And that's going to drag things out somewhat. And I guess I would ask you, would you entertain an amendment to drop the date out of this bill, set up the committee or commission, and let them come back next session with a date?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thompson, I appreciate that question, and of course, that's the, I think you'll hear testimony after Representative Cannon and I leave that sort of suggests the same thing. I understand that. I would just sort of, first of all, the state of Oregon is not leading on this.
Yeah, you're right.
Well, but I even mean with this legislation, with the hard, fast date, the get her done date, as I said, Oregon's still not leading. Minnesota's greatly leading on this. I was remiss for not mentioning this at the start of my testimony. Actually have an amendment that LC is drafting right now that would do two things, but most importantly, one thing, which is to make sure that whatever we're doing in Oregon falls within the sphere, for lack of a better way to describe it, of federal legislation, federal guidelines, federal implementation standards and dates. And that's, of course, very important because a big part, Mr. Chair, of the federal, a significant amount of monies within the federal stimulus package are going toward this. I mean, that's how important the federal government sees this issue, and I agree. I understand the issue of the date. We all know this is the right thing to do. I don't think there's anybody in this building that disagrees that, you know, moving toward a more compatible system of health information technology is the right thing to do. The problem is we've been going through fits and starts and frankly, at some point, excuses. And I want to move my motivation here is to sort of move the question away from should we do this to how we do this. And the question to me gets answered, you shift to the how we do this if you put a date on there. Now, there's a lot of time between now and the end of 2015. I mean, by my count, that's, three more regular sessions, including the 2015 regular session, not to mention the annual session. So I think there's plenty of time, and that would be my response. There's plenty of time for the governor's task force or whomever to come and say, hey, we appreciate this, but here's why that date isn't going to work. But I like to have a little bit of the teeth there, even if they're very small teeth. And this bill doesn't put any penalties for not hitting that 2015 timeline. It just says here's a 2015 timeline.
It's an aspiration.
It's an aspiration.
Do you know what's – is there a similar bill in the Senate? Did I hear it's one of the governor's? Well,
the governor has an HIT bill, but I think I don't think it has the date on it.
Is
I don't know that for
five,
a fact, Mr.
Four, three.
Yeah,
or something?
I don't. I just know there's another HIT.
There are about four bills being worked in the Senate. In fact, I think one of them may have passed today.
Yeah.
That the notion is when they pass them in the Senate and send it to Ways and Means, we'll put them into 2009. So that or this version could be a way to do that. This obviously has enough votes to get out of the committee because there are more than six members that are co-chair. So I suspect we're going to move it one way or the other, but we may get into a Ways and Means problem if we have it isolated by itself.
That's fine. I mean, I have no, not speaking for Representative Canada, it's not really a pride of ownership. It's even if it's in 2009, to put some hard and fast dates on
it. Well, thank you very much. We've got a few, yes, we have a few witnesses I'd like to get to.
Okay.
But go ahead if you have a question.
No, it's just, there's a difference between having an electronic health record and a hospital is a lot different than interoperability between the radiology at Salem Radiology and Salem Hospital. That's interoperable. And being able to look at the X-ray image in Grants Pass that was taken at OHSU, and that's interoperability. And I'm on the bill, but I have a concern with the date. It's an aspirational date. Totally understand that. In fact, I have an amendment. We're trying to work on a date that actually deletes a date. It's just Oregon's not going to set the standard. Oregon doesn't have the way. We're not the VHS beta test site, because that's really what we're talking about.
Actually, there is a set of systems that are moving in Oregon now. The Epic system, which is in Kaiser, OHSU, is now, I understand, I think it's Samaritan Health, and it's being used by all the safety net clinics. And it is an example of the kind of thing. But the fact is, what's different now than 4 years ago is technologically, this is not a big problem anymore. You just take everything from wherever it is, put it into a single database, and send it out to the users. It's actually at least technologically pretty simple now.
It may be so until you have to write the check.
Oh.
And when you write the check...
I didn't say it was cheap. I said it was technologically
Techie Joe
simple.
And Techie Joanne to do it.
Yeah.
It becomes... That becomes a hurdle.
This date is consistent with what's referred to as the mythical man months when it comes to how long does it take to develop systems. Let me call for brief testimony, please, from Dr. Greg Fraser, Steve Gafori, Lauren Rhodes, Gwen Dayton, and since we have a 5:30 other meeting where Ways and Means Subcommittee, is that right, tonight? We don't have a lot of time. Yes, sir.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Quick comment to Representative Maurer. This does not state, it does not mandate use of a system, and there once the data are standardized, there are all kinds of ways to share the data.
They're not cheap, though. He's right about that.
No, but it leaves it open to the market to figure out how to do it, and there are many ways to get there. We could go on a long time.
No, I agree. I agree. But I want to leave at 5.
That's why I said
or maybe 5 after. So that gives you the parameters. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I guess I'm going to have to talk very, very quickly. My name is Greg Fraser. I'm the Medical Director of Information Systems and Informatics at Mid-Valley Independent Physicians Association here in Salem. And it's my pleasure to speak to you briefly about House Bill 2850. Let me say at the outset, I absolutely support the adoption of electronic health records. I'm one who absolutely believes that the public interest would not be served by having isolated silos of electronic health data, that interoperability is key to achieving the benefits of electronic systems. That being said, I do have a couple of concerns about this bill that I will share with you, and I believe that Representative Bruin may have anticipated one of them with the amendment that he just spoke of. But my primary objection was with Section 3.2C, where it states that the task force would be required to develop uniform standards for interoperable electronic health information systems. And My opinion is that this is not a role that the state should take on, that there's a lot of work being done at the national and federal level on interoperability standards by a variety of organizations, the Health IT Standards Panel, the National eHealth Collaborative, the Certification Commission on Health IT, and the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act mandates the creation of a Health IT Standards Committee as a part of that legislation. And I want to encourage the state of Oregon not to develop a set of standards which may compete with those that are adopted nationally. I think it would put providers and vendors in a very difficult position were they to have to meet both federal standards and competing state standards.
Did you suggest that there was an amendment coming to that?
I suggested there's an amendment coming.
So it might be develop or adopt or something like that.
Yeah.
Right. So
would that make you in favor of the bill?
That would it would help. It would help. The second thing, and I will be very brief here, is, of course, the devil is in the details in terms of what is really meant by interoperability, and the standard definition is in the bill. There are several types of interoperability. There are several levels of interoperability. Some of these are extremely difficult to achieve and probably unrealistic to expect to be realized in the state of Oregon on this kind of time frame. Full semantic interoperability between electronic health record systems that come from different vendors really doesn't exist at this point in time. So a lot is really going to depend on what exactly is meant by interoperability and what standard of interoperability will be required in order to meet this mandate. And in that context, I actually kind of support an aspirational date, but I'm very concerned about the ability of the provider community in particular to meet this. Providers don't have the ability to create interoperable systems. All they can do is buy them. And so we're looking at really three groups of providers that exist right now, those that have EHR systems which are capable of at least some level of interoperability, those that have EMR systems that are not capable of much in the way of interoperability at this point in time, and those systems will need to be greatly improved or else replaced. And we have a very significant percentage of providers that have no electronic system whatsoever. And I know that 2015 seems like a long way away, but when we're dealing with those that are the late adopters and the laggards, it's the implementation of this kind of infrastructure is going to be very challenging. So what I would encourage the task force to do if this bill passes in the, whether it's the HIIAC or the Health Information Technology Oversight Council that I have heard rumors about from the governor's end of things, one of the things that I think the task force ought to do is inform its view of interoperability based on some evaluation of the organizations, the hospitals, the health systems, the physician organizations in the state that have been able to achieve some degree of interoperability to date. And I think I'll stop there and then invite questions after some others have had a chance to testify.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Lauren Rhodes representing the Oregon Healthcare Association. I will be brief. As somebody who can hardly use my computer, I'm certainly nowhere near as advanced on the topic, and I believe that probably our members, long-term care facilities across the state of Oregon, fall into the third camp that was just discussed in terms of providers who really don't have interoperable systems at this point in time. That said, we are extremely supportive of the concept that Representative Bruin has brought forth, and certainly do believe that that's the ticket to achieving higher quality and more efficient cost savings in all of the healthcare delivery system. In some research for this bill, found out that in the stimulus package that was passed by the federal government in February, significant portion of that included billions of dollars actually appropriated to the development of interoperable systems from the federal government's perspective, and they have a time frame of a 2-year plan to develop standards by which states can and should comply, and incentives for providers who contract for Medicare and Medicaid services to meet those standards. And so it's a from our perspective, we like the bill, but the 2015 date is a little bit concerning, considering where the federal government's going and the fact that they seem to be moving forward, and we would like to make sure that we just, as was mentioned, don't duplicate or make steps that would have to be retracted at a later date. So we'd like to work with the committee and moving forward on a very good and important concept, and just wanted to make our concerns about the 2015 deadline and the ambitious nature of that date known to all of you. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Greenlee, members of the committee. There's nothing like being last on a bill. My name is Gwen Dayton. I'm
Jennifer. You're the only thing that's standing between us and adjournment.
I know, and I have to go pick up my daughter's soccer, so I'm going to make this quick. I'm Gwen Dayton. I'm General Counsel for the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. And I want to reiterate, we really very genuinely appreciate the motivation behind this bill, and we completely support it. Your reference to sliced wonder bread is one that we support or agree with. And hospitals are very actively engaged in either have electronic health records or they're developing them. And many of those are already interoperable within the system. The challenge, I think, is making them interoperable, as Representative Maurer said, between the hospital and the radiology clinic or the physician's office or elsewhere. And we completely agree that's where we need to be. There's no question about that. Our concern is again with the 2015, whether that's something that can really meet, because we don't develop these things, we buy them. And right now as we speak, on the federal level, of course, there's a lot of activity around on this issue. And there are standards being developed nationally. And we, of course, want to follow those standards. I can't imagine a reason that we would want to be different than the rest of the country in those standards. And in many ways, we're waiting to see what those standards are going to be. I can't think that a hospital will go out and try to buy a system right now if it was available that was, quote-unquote, interoperable when the standards have not been developed on the national level. So we're all kind of watching that happen, and we would urge Oregon to let that happen as well. We note that in the national requirements, there is a reference to 2015, but it's encouraged. We are encouraged to have something in place by then. If we don't, we actually suffer monetary penalty through reduced payments from CMS. So we are strongly encouraged to make this happen. So there's nothing in my testimony that should suggest we're not motivated to make this happen. But we would urge Oregon to watch what's happening on the national level and follow that. If we want to have our own path in Oregon, as we sometimes do, and we support the idea of the task force to look at this issue, I think, and making it the same as the task force that's, I think, referenced in Senate Bill 452 makes sense to us. But we would, again, urge the task force to have some flexibility on the date. And the other thing that's very technical but that I note, we've talked about how, hey, we can always come back in different legislative sessions and adjust that date. This bill sunsets the task force in 2012. So after January 1 of 2012, there won't be a task force that's looking at this issue any longer. It'll be folks like us coming back to you in 2013 saying we don't think that it's going to work, but there's not going to be another group that's actually evaluating what would work. So that's just a technical issue that we have. But again, we very much appreciate this being brought to the forefront because it supports our efforts to make this happen. We just think that we don't need to necessarily fly with our own wings on this one.
I think we assume that when the task force sunsets in 2005, in 2012, it delivers the plan to the legislature to adopt in 2013, that implements everything, and consequently will be there by 2015. Simple. Well, maybe not.
If I could add just one more little thing, and I believe that the federal government knows that its objective to have people using electronic health information systems in a meaningful way is not going. The president's objective is 2014, and so the penalties that were spoken of for providers and hospitals go into effect in 2015. The Congressional Budget Office has actually budgeted for the recovery of billions of dollars in penalties for 2015, 16, and 17. So it could be suggested that they already know it isn't going to happen.
Boy, that'll lower health care costs.
Look forward to that.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2850, and we are adjourned.